sure is boring, sitting in the duck blind. Not hardly any ducks at all.
Real boring.
Blow that duck call again.
All right.
Let me ask you something.
What?
How about if we commit an act of sodomy?
I don't care much for salami.
No, sodomy. An act of sodomy.
Sodomy?
Right.
The two of us?
The two of us.
Well, it would help pass the time.
That's what I'm thinking.
I do see one or two problems with that.
Like, such as?
We're Bible-believing, and Scripture says it's an abomination.
I don't know. I've been reading the work of this Harvard theologian, Peter Gomes. He raises some real interesting exegetical questions. For instance, he says the passages that forbid homosexuality also forbid eating raw meat, planting two different kinds of seed in the same field, wearing garments with two different kinds of yarn, tattoos, adultery, and sexual intercourse during a woman's menstrual period. You don't see people getting all worked up about that stuff.
Well, I reckon there's another problem there.
What?
I'm a woman.
With that big old beard? You sure?
Positive.
You had me fooled.
I've been thinking about electrolysis.
I can't see you running for office.
That ain't what it means. Hey, there go some ducks. I'm blow the duck call.
It don't work like that. You don't blow the call when the ducks are already flying by. What are they gonna do? Turn around and come back?
That's the kind of thing they might figure out on this here radio show, The Notes. Today they're talking about us, and Netflix, adultery, and an essay about happiness. And now a feller who knows a little too much about Broadway musicals for my peace of mind, Colin McEnroe.
All right, thanks very much to the members of Duck Dynasty who are out there on the duck blind. Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about who's here and then what we're going to do. With us here from Kinetic Dance, who has a – she's a big – I can't even believe she's here. She has a huge pro show opening tonight, but Carolyn Payne is with us now, also actress, comedian, many other things besides. Luis Figueroa, a professor from Trinity College. Jim Chapdelaine, musician and producer extraordinaire. They're all with us. And in just a little while, we are going to talk about an essay by Arthur Brooks that you may have seen in your New York Times Sunday Weekend Review last Sunday about happiness, about sort of the statistical correlations between happiness and other states of life. We're also going to talk about this concept of Netflix adultery, although I feel like Netflix is getting too big a publicity ride out of this. The whole idea is when you watch something that you and your significant other or other people who are important to you in your life have agreed that you're going to watch together, you go off and watch it on your own. Anyway, we'll explain all that to you later. But of course, we have to begin with Duck Dynasty. All of our panelists have gone from essentially 0 to 60 on Duck Dynasty, from going almost knowing almost nothing about Duck Dynasty to knowing way too much about it to the extent that it's actually starting to interfere with their lives. But just to recap, Duck Dynasty is a very popular, incredibly popular reality show on the network A&E. It is about a bunch of family and some of their familiars who run a company that makes duck calls and other sporting goods. I think they make other things. But anyway, they've just turned into this gigantic cottage industry because the show is very popular. There are all kinds of spin-off merchandise, and it's just a massive sub-industry. And the paterfamilias of the family, patriarch Phil Robertson, gave an interview, a big profile in the January issue of GQ magazine. He's a very, very strong evangelical Christian, very outspoken about it. He equated homosexual. Well, I don't know if he equated it. That's what people are saying. I'm not quite sure.
I read the quote.
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward.
He lumped it in, which I think is different from equating.
He drew the line from this to that.
Okay. He connected certain dots with homosexuality, with bestiality. Talked about sin. Talked about – I mean, we can get into some of his actual quotes. I'll be happy or unhappy to share them with you. This has resulted in his suspension from the show, something that the viewers will not feel for a while because the first 9 episodes and the next 9 episodes of the show are already shot. He's in them. But it's also turned into this violent publicity storm for all kinds of stakeholders, ranging from GLAAD and other gay rights groups who, of course, have denounced him, to Republican candidates for president in 2016. Who have,
ducks.
And ducks have been – everybody's gotten involved. So I don't know. Where should we start on this? Since you're already chiming in, Chapdelaine, you have
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm chomping
champing
had to be here.
Champing at the door.
Yeah, this whole thing put squirrels in my britches, I'll tell you.
I don't think ducks can champ, but go ahead.
Well, they could quack. I mean, so for me, I think it's a very big package to unpack. So
yes. So
let's go back in time.
You could have put that differently, but go ahead.
I could have, yeah. It's a big duck to feather. So let's go back in time a little bit to the Dixie Chicks. Mm-hmm. And what had the same people who are so outraged with A&E suspending Phil, which, you know, whatever. It's a little slap in the wrist. He'll be back. They'll make more money, whatever. Were the same people that banished the Dixie Chicks to oblivion and practically ended their careers. And these same people, just a few short weeks ago, petitioned to get rid of Alec Baldwin and Martin Bashir. And they were summarily dismissed for, you know, I think Martin Bashir made some pretty vile and vulgar comments about Sarah Palin. And he was banished much as Phil is. Mm-hmm. But they have couched it very cleverly in freedom of religion. So you can say these things as long as you're holding some sort of religious badge, of merit badge. And that's the part. I think they've forgotten that they're the guys who serve this dish up first.
Well, that's possibly true. By the way, our number, if you want to comment on this, and I urge you to call early rather than later because we do move on to other things, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Maybe one of the things we should do, though, is to set the stage even a little bit more for people. I mean, all of us, I think, were pretty unfamiliar with Duck Dynasty prior to our involvement in this crisis, which has so gripped the nation. So, Carolyn, I don't know, is there any way you can kind of describe, I mean, what is it we're talking about? What is this show?
All right, so it's dudes with these huge beards. They live in Louisiana. They have wives that look like, you know, the Real Housewives. They look like they belong on a cast of Real Housewives on Bravo.
Country Club.
Right. And but then you have these guys and with their beards wearing their camo. And I was blissfully unaware of this show. I mean, I had heard about it. But then when the holidays hit, I was in Walgreens and they had a Duck Dynasty holiday display. And that was when I realized, like, oh, God, this is really a thing. Like, and then I started to kind of tune into this more. And then when this all happened, I then DVR'd a bunch of the shows. When I got home from the theater last night, I powerhoused through about 6 episodes of Duck Dynasty rather than sleeping. So now that probably didn't help me make good judgments on them. But basically, it is a very highly scripted reality show that focuses on these guys, you know, them being hillbillies doing things like yoga or taking their kids to get their wisdom teeth removed.
It is the Beverly Hillbillies, basically.
It is.
Right, right. It is about backwoods bumpkins who come
into
a lot of money.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can understand how, like, it kind of feeds into that American dream of, you know, if they can do it, you can do it. But
it's also sort of Southern culture not on the skids.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of in like this is
what
how
do you mean
really
not in the skids?
Well, it's Southern culture embodied as a successful lifestyle, and I'm sure many people live that way and live perfectly happily that way, and I really don't have much issue with it. But my issue is if you're going to say those things, own them.
So it's Boba 2.0, in a way.
Well,
when I first started reading about this in the last couple of days, the first thing that struck me was that the season premiere for this season back in August drew an audience that at the time was about 12 million people. It's estimated to be the largest audience to ever watch a nonfiction show on cable television in the history of American television. So with that little data point, I decided to watch it, like Catherine, last night, quite late. And so I began to try to figure out what's going on. And the first reaction is kind of like a simple one. It is natural. It's banality. It's reality show. It's all kinds of things. But then I read the article in the New York Times before I went to sleep where they described the reaction, the counter reaction by their fans, all right? Mm-hmm. Who adore this. And one of the pieces that I got from that is people saying that this is one of the few shows on American television that they feel they can watch with the whole family together.
Mm-hmm.
That is not segmented by particular kinds of demographics in their view, although clearly it is. But the notion that it's kind of a wholesome show for the entire family, and for whatever reason, it brought me memories of when we used to get together all at home back in the day to watch Ponderosa on Puerto Rican television on Wednesday nights, you know, everyone watching it. But then I tried to go a little bit beyond that surface. And I think that Caroline and you guys are already suggesting some very good points. I think that this is a way for a certain kind of America to cling to certain notions of what America is supposed to be.
Bibles,
guns. But updating them to, that's why I call it Boba 2.0, updating them in particular kinds of ways. I don't want to elaborate right now, just want to listen to all of you too. But I think that there is an ingredient of this, that there is a significant segment of American society that feels being left behind by certain changes in American society and is trying to hold on in the present circumstances. I can elaborate later, but I'm just trying to make sense of this without being negatively judgmental, because, you know, it's very easy for me to say, well, you know, it's kind of banality, reality TV, it's all a hoax and this and that. But I'm trying to understand it within its own framework.
Just a couple of quick things I want to react to that. I mean, I think the point that you're making is a really interesting one, and I can't remember where I heard this or where I read it, but I think it was Walmart or some big company was saying that in terms of the merchandise, you know, they don't sell that much in Houston, for example, but the further they get away from Houston out into the hinterlands, the more they can't keep it on the shelves. I mean,
yeah.
There's this, and I think that's what you're talking about, Luis, a whole group of people who feel like they're sort of left behind by the media, by the national conversation. Well, this is
by really, the economy.
Yeah, by the economy, too. This mm-hmm. really speaks to them. Maybe this will sort of provoke a little bit of conversation. I've had probably a slightly different reaction to this than people might expect, people who know me well might expect, which is that, I mean, I really, first of all, I think A&E is foolish to suspend this guy, and I think they're sort of wrong to suspend him, too. I mean, I'm sort of a big believer in speech, all kinds of speech, even speech that I don't like that much. And, you know, I mean, he's entitled to go give a magazine interview and say this stuff. I mean, it's the show that they're showing. Part of the show that they're showing is about this Bible-believing family. Well, guess what? That's what Bible-believing people think. And although his quotes are unpleasant, and we can share some of them, I think for the most part they fall short of hate speech. I mean, he's not really urging anybody to do anything bad to anybody.
I think
else.
You're right.
I agree with
a
that.
Friend of mine said it's like, and this is probably politically incorrect, but he said it's like filming a show about a family who has Tourette's syndrome and then pretending you're surprised at what they say. and yeah, you're right. I don't even have an objection to him staying on air. My concern is with this virulent sort of uprising backlash, and Luis is speaking to that, to this audience that feels disenfranchised by everything American, and somehow these guys embody it.
But suspending him, I mean, that it feeds that.
That gives a rally.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It's,
absolutely.
It's the Lexington and Concord of cultural departure or something like that.
I mean, everybody gets to fundraise off this, right? GLAAD will get to fundraise off it. All the gay groups will get to fundraise off it. Log Cabin Republicans, they can fundraise off it. And then all the right-wing groups will get to fundraise off it.
And the Tea Party and everybody else. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Sarah Palin and Bobby Jindal.
It's another fundraising machine that just generated instantly.
It was giant. It just became giant so quickly. I thought it was just going to blow over.
I mean,
but it became enormous so quickly. That's what I think is fascinating about it.
I think a lot of that is just because he is getting suspended from the show.
Mm-hmm.
The show has such popular appeal. And I love reality TV. Like, I am the first one to admit, I will sit and watch like 12 hours straight of Honey Boo Boo and, you know, Toddlers and Tiaras. I mean, anything.
In an adulterous
Pawn Stars.
Netflix way?
Yeah.
We're
yes.
coming to that.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But, I mean, this show just doesn't do it for me, but I can understand, like, if they took, you know, I'm a big fan of that show Pawn Stars on History Channel, and if they took one of those guys off the show, if they took, like, Rick off the show, I don't think I wouldn't be able to go on.
The fact that you know them by first names.
Yeah. Oh, we're on a first name basis.
Yeah. if we try to kind of, like, parcel this out or maybe, like, unpack it, whatever metaphor we want to use, I can quickly point out certain little details that we could elaborate here today, or the audience also would love to hear from them. One is the issue of, again, how changes are taking place in America, and people are trying to cling on to certain notions, what at the same time kind of like do the version 2.0. Gender, in that it couldn't be more traditional. The whole show is filmed and edited. The storytelling is from the from a male perspective, and the women are presented as these pestering female dogs, because I cannot use the other word on radio.
Well, I think there's also, also sort of long-suffering.
Yeah.
But they're sort of quietly smarter than the men.
Yes, quietly smarter.
At the end, the women win because that's right, the women are smarter.
Yeah, but then the men are presented as victims of this kind of like certain kind of woman, at least on the pieces that I saw. Then there is a whole issue of race that is involving the quotes, because a lot of people have focused, I think probably almost everybody that I've seen, except for Colbert, to his credit, has focused on the issues of sexuality.
If you're going to lead into race, let me just grab a quick call here from Tim in Bethany, because I think he wants to address the same thing you want to talk about, Louisa. By the way, our number 860-275-7266, if you're as transfixed by the Duck Dynasty crisis as we are. Tim, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. First off, let me just say, for as someone from the South originally, a lot of us out there are just absolutely cringing with this whole idea that everybody from the South is a hillbilly. And we, you know, we have to kind of look the other way. But I think the real comments that are probably going to sneak out are the fact that, you know, he has also said that blacks were happier before the Civil Rights Act. They used to sing and dance.
Yeah, I'll not sing the blues,
as I recall.
The exact quote here is, "I never with my eyes saw the mistreatment of any black person, not once. Where we lived was all farmers. The blacks worked for the farmers. I hoed cotton with them. I'm with the blacks because we're white trash. We're going across the field. They're singing and happy. I never heard one of them, one black person, say, 'I tell you what, these doggone white people,' not a word. Pre-entitlement, pre-welfare, you say, were they happy? They were godly. They were happy. No one was singing the blues."
Well, I don't feel sorry for them, because obviously, number one, these guys are millionaires from that stupid duck calling thing, so I don't feel sorry for them. Number two, you know, they are also men who signed a contract with an agency where they can be terminated at will, and they knew in those contracts saying things like this, from a morality point of view, was going to probably bite them. So let the marketplace, not the government, the marketplace will dictate them. As a lot of people see this kind of underbelly, they may kind of give it a second chance and say, maybe that's not really for me. So let the marketplace dictate, guys.
Great point. I just want to say about this, though. I mean, I don't feel sorry for them either. I think wasting one's pity on the Robertsons would really be truly foolish. They are living like kings these days. And my problem with this is it has reminded me a little bit of the Don Imus controversy.
Or how about Martin Bashir or Alec Baldwin or any of these guys who get kind of bumped out of there for saying idiotic things.
Well, yeah. But I think the Imus controversy in particular, because Don Imus always talked like that. He was sort of a guilty pleasure for a lot of people. His show was incredibly sexist, incredibly, at times, really trading on a kind of racist step and fetch at Amos and Andy kind of racial humor. And it was a guilty pleasure for all kinds of wonderful people. I mean, Jeff Greenfield was on there all the time. Frank Rich was a regular guest. Joe Lieberman, of course, used to go on and complain about the decline of morals in the culture on the Don Imus show, where the you know, the minute he left, they would do a show.
With no self-awareness.
The minute he hung up, they would do a three-minute skit about, you know, Hillary Clinton's genitalia or something like that. I said, do you have any idea what show you were on? So then he does like this one thing that kicks a tripwire and gets a little bit more publicity. And suddenly CBS Radio and everybody, they're all really worried about this, and he has to be suspended and all this kind of stuff. And it seems a little similar here. This is the thing you decided to exhibit, A&E, and you've made a lot of money doing it. Let's not pretend, you know, that isn't what this is. I mean, suddenly it's not that A&E has come to their senses or has recognized any particular set of principles. They're just worried about phone calls and sponsor
boycotts.
There's
a PR firm that's making a lot of money right now because of exactly what you're saying, because of just a micro fragment of the content that came out.
I would agree. Yeah, go ahead, Caroline.
Well, the reality of a reality show is, or any show that a network is producing, is they can control what happens on the show. They can't control what happens, what the people who are on the show are doing. I mean, obviously, they can hold them accountable for their actions. But in the show, we were talking about this before. I was watching it last night. There was the episode where there was the wedding. They had like a marriage ceremony, or I guess a re-ceremony or something. And I'm watching it, and my roommate, I live with a gay man, and, you know, he comes in, and I'm trying to explain to him why I'm watching this show, and he watches it for 5 seconds, and he's aware of the only reason he's aware of this show now is because of this controversy, and he's watching this, and he's like, they hate gay men? Really? He's like, who did that flower arrangement? That was a gay man. And he walked out of the room. And, you know, I think that that just shows that here we have this network who is producing the show. And like I said, it is very, if you watch this, it is incredibly highly produced. It almost feels like they're reading lines sometimes.
Well, they do say their lines multiple times.
They're
I know that from people who have been on reality
shows. I've been an actor on a reality show, and right. It is definitely not reality.
So the key word is actor.
Yes.
So, you know, our own Patty McQueen, just an hour before we came on, posted this a video of a Southern guy going on a rant and showing pictures of them pre-A&E. And basically, they're guys with no beard.
Exactly.
At a golf tournament. And they're like bro culture, and they're millionaires. Mm-hmm. So they were already millionaires, and this is just a way to rebrand, and all of a sudden they're in face paint, and it looks like Apocalypse Now. I mean, when it first came on, I was pretty entertained by it for a few issues. I guess you call them issues. It's a magazine style. But I think Lewis hit it on the head here with the demo being the people reacting, because Martin Bashir's demo did not react virulently, or Alec Baldwin, nobody like, all right, see ya.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I mean, Alec Baldwin's show wasn't very good. That's
he
gave them a really good reason to cancel it. Yeah. Let me just grab a call here from Kristen in Storrs. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Colin. How are you?
Good. You're on the air.
I have to disagree with you about the whole freedom of speech thing. In fact, I don't know why people even use that phrase in connection with this whole controversy.
Just before you go on, in my defense, I said I was in favor of speech. I didn't say freedom of speech. And I understand this is not a First Amendment issue. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. But that's certainly what you're reading and hearing when other people are talking about it. And unless he was arrested for his stupidity, mm-hmm. it's not a freedom of speech issue. He gets to say whatever he wants and not be arrested. But you can say whatever you want and not have consequences from your boss, your family, your friends, your neighbors, whoever. So if A&E, if this was important to them, that they not have some big person on their network saying hate things about gay people, then they should suspend him.
Here's the thing, though, and here's where you and I do disagree. And to me, there are really qualitative differences, important qualitative differences among different kinds of speech. So was Don Imus reprehensible in his treatment of Sandra Fluke? Absolutely. That was bullying.
Yeah.
That was bullying. That was insulting. That was an attempt to, in fact, to sort of back her off her opinions by sullying her reputation and saying the most horrible possible things about her that he. So did Don Imus deserve anything that happened? Don Imus. Did Rush Limbaugh deserve anything that happened to him in that situation? Absolutely. And in fact, that was an instance in which a certain amount of boycotting and stuff like that, it really did work. Some of the sponsors got nervous. I mean, so Rush Limbaugh will make, you know, $37 million this year instead of 38 or something like that. But still, it kind of worked, and I think it should have worked. I think that was important. This guy did something different. First of all, off of his platform, in a magazine interview, he basically just said what he believes. This is what he believes. He wasn't trying to hurt anybody. He wasn't trying to encourage anybody to hate anybody else. He just talked about sort of what his actual religious beliefs are. And I'm uncomfortable, not at the level of constitutional infringement, because I understand it's not that, but I'm uncomfortable with punishing somebody for that. And once again, they're not really punishing him. It's impossible
That's
to punish
right.
anybody like this. But I'm uncomfortable with A&E sort of saying, well, you know what? He's not entitled to go say what it is that he believes. I didn't see any real malice in this. It just happens to be his religion and what he believes.
My problem – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Kristen.
Never mind. I forgot what I was going to say.
That's all right. You'll recover it. Send me an email when you get it back. It's Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Luis, you're going to have the last word in this.
I'm sorry. I sort of interrupted that conversation. But my problem is the duplicity on the part of A&E. Mm-hmm. That's my problem, because they knew what these guys' views are. And they were making tons of money off all kinds of things that were connected to the show. Because it's not that they're making only money from the advertisement on the show, they get a cut, I'm pretty sure, because I've seen contracts like this, on all the merchandise.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right? So that the merch, I mean, the Christmas album is like the number one selling Christmas album in the
Duck
country.
The halls.
And they can keep it on the store. So it's the duplicity of a corporate organization like A&E of putting this out, giving all this, during the show, all kinds of things go on, giving them a platform. And then all of a sudden, when people protest on in this specific instance, then they're going to bring him back because it's also a very stupid suspension. The show's already recorded.
And that'll be 24 million people.
Yes. Yeah. So that's, to me, that's even a bigger problem is the corporate duplicity on the part of this network.
All right. We have to take a pause here. We'll come back. We'll be leaving Duck Dynasty. We'll be exploring happiness and Netflix adultery. So the way that we do the nose is at sort of as soon as we get ourselves organized into a panel, we start sending links around. People start bringing up different things that we might talk about. So today on the nose, Carolyn Payne, Luis Figueroa, and Jim Chapdelaine are here. And so as we were emailing things around, I think it was Luis who first directed us to an article that I'd seen over the weekend. It's on the cover of the Sunday Week in Review in the New York Times. It's by Arthur Brooks, who runs a think tank in New York. It was about happiness. And it's sort of – some of it's kind of familiar ground. There's a whole world of scholarship called cognitive well-being or happiness studies, kind of tries to figure out what it is actually that makes people happy, what correlates in a significant way with happiness. He's using some of that research to make certain arguments. He basically says, beneath these averages are some demographic differences. For many years, researchers found that women were happier than men, although recent studies contend that the gap is narrowed, may even have been reversed. Political junkies might be interested to know that conservative women are particularly blissful. About 40% say they are very happy. That makes them slightly happier than conservative men and significantly happier than liberal women. The unhappiest of all are liberal men, only about a fifth of them consider themselves happy. And then goes on to sort of talk about what does seem to make people happy. A lot of it you can't control. It's your genes and other stuff that's just not within your control. I think he isolates about 12% of your life or your happiness is stuff that's a little bit more fungible, stuff that you can move around. Has a lot to do with whether or not you're happy in your work. Have you found some job that makes you happy? And then at that point, it doesn't make any difference whether you make a lot of money or not. I'm trying to summarize this as fast as I can. Anything beyond the average middle-class income level, including big financial gains, doesn't seem to yield much, if any, increase in happiness. He talks in the end about sort of trying to create a world in which people can access that kind of happiness, where they can have the things they need and have the chance to do the work that would be meaningful to them. Because he's from the American Enterprise Institute, this turns into something of a love letter to free enterprise at the end. So, Luis, you directed our attention to this. You get to explain why it is that we're talking about it. Although I think you've had some changes of heart about this article.
First of all, the reason I first was attracted to reading about it, I think it's because of the time we're in. Maybe if the article came out in June, maybe I have a different attitude. But I think that for a lot of people, I think it's natural. We come into the end of the year, and a lot of times my mind wanders and begins to think, well, how was my year? Was it good? Am I happy? Not happy? And second, a lot of people then go through the process at this time of the year of getting into, like, New Year's resolutions that are all meant to try to make them happier. And then I run into this article. And so the first thing that I read and drew my attention is that, according to this research, a significant proportion of happiness is explained by your genes. And he talks about this research with identical twins that were separated at birth. And I thought, genes. So I never thought about that. And then he talks about family, community, other things. But later, upon further review, as they say in the NFL, I realized that this article is really a Trojan horse for something else. And that it becomes more clear when you actually click on the link that appears on the second paragraph of the article, and what you end up in is a video lecture presentation by this fellow who's the president of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank, that is concentrating on the issue of values, but one particular value, and that is free enterprise. I'll talk about that later, but I think that we could have at least a productive conversation without getting into the politics of it necessarily. How do we define happiness?
All right. Well, Carolyn, you were saying before we went on the air, this is supposed to be the happy time of year, and you're having a sort of a disconnect, right?
Yeah, the holidays are the most wonderful time of the year. But for me, I it might be like, you know, Nutcracker stress talking. I mean, I've done the Nutcracker now for like 23 years, so maybe I can't even remember a Christmas without that. So that may be part of it. But I find particularly this is like just a miserable time of year for a lot of people. People are miserable, like driving. I mean, people become psychopaths. Like, yeah, you better go get those Duck Dynasty ornaments. I mean, it's just I don't know. So maybe this was a hard time of year for me to, like, you know, look at happiness and examine it. But when I was reading this and it said that, you know, most liberal women are unhappy, I'm like, all right, I'm a woman and I'm definitely a liberal. I don't consider myself unhappy. I definitely think I have a borderline unhealthy amount of rage with things. But I think that the reason liberals...
You wouldn't know it, though, Carolyn. So right now, you would never know.
You would never know. Yeah. But most, I think the reason liberals are less happy than conservatives, in my opinion, I feel like as a liberal, and just me as a person in what I do in my work, I'm always trying to change things and evolve and get to the next step. And I wonder if that is a characteristic with liberals beyond politics, like beyond your political beliefs, if it's just how you view life. Like if you watch that show Portlandia, they have this great quote where, you know, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. Now, not like if you're obviously... You know, but it's, I think the liberals get themselves outraged because they're always, you know, listening to everything and thinking, you know, how do I make this better? So I wonder if that has to do with this.
Well, let me just interject one thing about this, because one of the things that happened as a result of this article, which was widely circulated, a lot of people read it, a lot of people talked about it, but the statisticians who looked at it had a very different set of reactions to it, which is that they felt that Arthur Brooks had misinterpreted or at least not quite understood the some of the surveys that he was looking at. He's looking at this thing called, I think it's called the General Statistical Survey, the GSS, which is this incredible trove of information. The problem was that when you punch it up on the web, what you get is all the numbers from 1972 forward in an aggregated state, which is a pretty unsubtle measure. So if you look at, say, the last 4 years, conservative women are actually much more unhappy than almost any other group. And it was sort of interesting because one of his phrases was sort of the Tea Party women are happier than anybody else. That's not really true. That during the Tea Party era, conservative women aren't that happy. So as you get into the sort of the specific eras, it gets a little different. Jim, what were you going
to
say?
Speaking to Carolyn's point, I think there's a mindset where the world is not black or white. It's just a different shades of gray. And I think somebody who's intellectually curious examines things and comes up with whatever solution or worldview they come up with that vacillates depending on whatever information is coming at them.
Right. So I think that regardless of being a conservative or liberal, I wonder if it's more people who tend to be...
You haven't embraced a template.
Right.
For thinking.
People, regardless of politics, I think it's more of how you view the world. Like, I think it inhibits your ability to be happy if you are constantly looking to make something, you know,
change.
To change.
According to this prescription, I should be miserable, but I'm not.
Louise, let me give you my reaction to this, and I want to hear yours. You know, I was reading this article, and a lot of the argument that he makes is that, first of all, our attitudes towards money are unrealistic. They doesn't have that much to do with happiness. Once you reach pretty much a middle-class status, getting a lot more money is not really going to make you happy, whereas having meaningful work will make you a lot more happy. First of all, I thought, well, we should all be working for public radio. That's exactly what things are.
I'm sending my application. Yeah.
But the more that I read sort of the argument and his description, how he interpreted the data about happiness, it seemed as though if the goal is to make people happy, if what we really want is to make people happy, and that was at least the argument that he seemed to be taking up, well, kind of, you know, a European model makes a little bit more sense, you know, which is, okay, we're going to agree about this. But a European – so a model where, yeah, you're probably not going to have an opportunity to be 422 times as rich as somebody else who lives in your town. In fact, you know, your incomes are probably going to be a little bit more comparable. A lot of your other needs are going to be taken care of, so you're not going to have to worry about where your health care comes from and stuff like that. So you're maybe freer to pursue the kind of work that you want to do. It doesn't have to come with health insurance attached to it. If what you really want to do is X, you can go and do it and hope to make a reasonable amount of money, not become incredibly rich. Significantly, in international studies of happiness, and it's a little hard to compare people's attitudes of happiness culture to culture. The European and especially the Northern European countries, the Scandinavian countries, always come in first. And the United States comes in, I think, 17th or something. So anyway, I'll hand it off to you.
Fish oil.
Well, first of all, I say that the media through which you consume ideas has a lot to do with how you respond to them. When I saw the article, I was thinking, well, this is a good news topic and whatever. And then I decided to click on that video, and I want to come back to that. Because when I saw the video, first of all, the guy came across kind of creepy, presenter, in a way very smarmy, to transition, link back to last week's conversation here in the news. It reminded me many years ago, something I had completely forgotten, when a friend of mine trying to recruit me to work for Amway, he took me to one of these Amway seminars to where they tried to you know, give you the Kool-Aid to become an Amway salesperson. That's what it sounded like. But at one point, as the presentation progresses, he goes into this diatribe against socialism, against social change, against the issue that money is the issue and wealth is the issue. But, like you said, wealth is important, or accessing money is important for people who are in the lower half, or actually, if you think
lower
about
fifth,
it,
I think it's really.
Well, yeah, but in fact, he said, well, when you get to a certain point in the middle class, we're talking about like 85% of people for whom money will be important. And so, but money is not important because the people who have it, it doesn't matter to them. Mm-hmm. And then he goes into this presentation. So to me, is a way, in a way, you know what, now that I'm thinking in the middle of this, is that this links up to the Duck Dynasty. Again,
okay.
I'm sad to say, or maybe not, because again, this is like a corporate ideological message here that is being sent. That only if you work harder and you believe in certain kinds of conservative values, that will make you happier. And you should not think about the money or the minimum wage that you're making. You should think about other values in your life, and that's what we're gonna make you. It's like the guy, I can't remember his name. There's a character in the Duck Dynasty who's one of the employees. There are two of them. And they're just happy-go-lucky. The millionaires and their employees in the warehouse. That's part of what is going on here.
Yeah, I think you're right. The Duck Dynasty puts on display kind of the values of this essay, which is that, you know, in this kind of unfettered world of capitalism, you can make a lot of money, and you know, if you have that opportunity, then you can realize your dreams and do things that are meaningful to you. But really, they're also kind of offering
you. But the money doesn't necessarily make you happy.
Yeah, and I mean, it seems to me the statistics that he cited didn't really support.
But I
read other
studies
where
that.
Yeah, but I can only throw one statistic, and I'll.
And then we have to move on to Netflix adulthood.
Yes, that he said, so I can't remember exactly the number, and as a professor, I feel bad for not being able to do that. But I think it was like five people in America are very happy and satisfied with their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, really? Really?
It's one of the smart Annies, Dillard or Beatty or Tyler or something, that said, as we spend our days, so we spend our lives. Mm-hmm. That's the only prescriptive sort of self-help happiness that I could sort of buy into. The rest of it is there's an aisle. There's a whole aisle for everybody who wants this.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick tweets here. Somebody quotes Deepak Chopra. Regal Drug quotes Deepak Chopra. Happiness is a continuation of happenings which are not resisted. And Matthew Russo tweets, liberals have trouble ignoring what's happening in society. I think conservatives can get lost in their community easier. Therefore, that would be why they might be happier. We have to move on. We want to reserve a little bit of time for, and it probably only deserves a little bit of time, although something that we can talk about a lot. Netflix in particular is kind of trumpeting this. It's actually a phrase that was coined by a New York Magazine writer, Netflix adultery. The idea basically is that now that you have DVRs, you have Netflix, you have Amazon TV on demand, things like that, you can watch something whenever you want. You don't have to sit down with your friends and loved ones to watch the final episode of Seinfeld together. Everybody can watch whatever they want. But there's still this kind of premium we place on watching things with the people we love or with our friends or whatever. There's sort of date television or date movies. Because people have so much freedom now, they can kind of cheat on one another. And this one study, which Netflix is all excited about, says 51% of relationships experience at least some pressure from the so-called Netflix adultery when somebody watches three episodes of Breaking Bad without waiting for the other person, and maybe then lies about it. Now, Carolyn, you've fallen victim to this, actually. People in your life have betrayed you and hurt you.
I have been betrayed. It actually started before Netflix even. I had I was anxiously awaiting the Harry Potter film, one of the Harry Potter films, and the guy I was dating at the time, we had vowed to go see it, and we go to see it, and it turned out that he had seen it without me, with a group of friends.
Terrible.
And he lied about it, because he knew I was going to be mad, and we're sitting there watching the movie, and he was so dumb, he managed to let something slip that was about to happen, and I was like, how did you know about
that?
He's
a wizard.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, Voldemort, he's not going to have a nose. Like, I don't know what it was that he let go, but I... connected things. I was like, did you see this movie? We're in the movie theater. And I start, you know, arguing with him. And he finally comes out that he saw the movie without me. And I stormed out and I refused to see that Harry Potter. And then incidentally, because I had missed that one, I didn't want to see the rest. It just ruined the whole thing. And that's a thing.
It turns out at the end of Harry Potter was a woman.
Thank
it was,
you.
And it was all a dream.
Spoiler.
Yeah.
And he wakes up with Suzanne Plouchette.
I knew that part.
So no, why did you feel so betrayed by that particular thing, though?
Just, well, I mean, lying aside, the lying was pretty lame there. But just the fact that it was something that we had set that we were going to do together, that we were going to experience this together because we had seen the other ones together. Mm-hmm. So I was looking forward to that. So it just felt like slimy to me that he would have experienced this, had this first experience with it.
And was he dressed in camo?
Yeah.
Now, Luis,
with popcorn in his beer.
I think, go ahead.
Luis, you and your significant other, you do some binge watching, right? You get interested in something like Mad Men or Breaking Bad.
I mean, we're trying to now finish the season of Homeland. We're a little bit behind, but we're doing our best.
So is there a rule that you have to watch these things together?
Well, first of all, it never occurred to us, this issue.
That's because your relationship is so strong, it never occurred to you that one of you would even think about it.
No. But then it came up. It's just coincidence. It came up the other day, right? So we're trying to catch up with Homeland. We just ended, but we don't want to know. Please don't tell me anything. And so we're watching it, and my partner falls asleep a couple of times throughout the episode. And when this happened, it's happened to me too in the past, happened to her. So, okay, I think we better just close this episode and try to come back in a couple of days. And so then she asked me, so do you watch, because I said, do you watch the episode? I said, no, I wouldn't do it. Because for me,
you're a
smart
man.
For me, because the fun of it is actually watching it together, right? A several individual. And I would say this, the same happens not only in terms of a relationship, but also how I prefer to watch films. I prefer to watch films in a theater. Not with two or three people, just like a whole bunch of people. For me, it's a social experience, and how we react and comment, and maybe there will be like a word that you jump in or you stop when you were doing Netflix. You stop there to make some editorial comment. That's the fun of it, for me at least. So, and I think that the other question is then how these people approach sex. Is the other part that I thought. You know, where people who are more
I think they
Netflix,
like to do that with the other person.
That's, I think and that's also a binge thing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but are the people who do Netflix adultery more
more likely to commit
actual adultery?
I think Carolyn might have decided that about that guy.
That's kind of where that story ends up.
All right. All right. So, Jim, we're going to run out of time here.
Okay, briefly, my wife and I, because I was on the road when we got together six nights a week, Sunday night was our night. So 9 o'clock Sunday, like sacrosanct. Just nobody, no phones, no nothing. I forget what it started, maybe the Whistling X-Files, and then we morphed it to The Sopranos, and then every other thing. So we're very vulnerable to whatever is on. It could be Duck Dynasty is on at that time, and we would religiously watch it. So now we have just entered the world of on-demand together. But my wife falls, she only has two speeds, like awake and highly efficient, and then off. And turn that down. And really, it's below the hearing of a mouse. So I've stopped watching those things with her. And we kind of make time to watch those things together. And I acknowledge that we have different sleeping patterns and stuff like that. So I don't see that there's a moral attachment to this that's going to affect us in the end.
This has come up in my life a lot of different ways. I was in Europe on a bike trip for 2 weeks this summer. My significant other actually was, as far as I can tell, Netflix faithful on all the shows that mattered to me.
You can always check the record. Right?
Yeah, that's right. She waited for me to come back. We have a couple of sort of ways in which we have sort of an open marriage. For example, I've explained to her that if she's going to be out of town for a week, and it's not going to matter. I don't think there's anything. But if Game of Thrones is on, I've explained to her I will watch Game of Thrones. Yeah. Without you, I don't care. I'm not waiting for you to come back. I have to see Game of Thrones right away. But I'm honest about it. I would never, you know.
I think that's the key with this.
That's the key.
Yeah.
No
North
sneaking.
Right.
Yeah. All right. We have to leave enough time
for
endorsements.
Do I smell Game of Thrones on your collar?
Exactly. Do I smell Lannister on you? All right. We have to take a break. We'll be right back.
Happiness is two kinds of ice cream.
Knowing a secret.
Climbing a tree.
Happiness is five different crayons.
Catching a firefly. Setting...
It's no surprise to me that people are deceitful and untrustworthy. It's just like the last episode of Walking Dead when the governor captured Michonne and Herschel. And not that I saw that episode yet. I mean, not exactly. I mean, I just turned it on and fast-forwarded because I heard they had a tip about how to get brains out of a linen blouse. I swear that's everything. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Corey Breen and Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Paul Rudd. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin and appeared in today's intro. For links, stories, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff dressed in camo and bandanas and fake beards, visit our great website, WNPR.org. On Monday, we'll be scrambling for guests and topics. And now, back to Colin.
Time for endorsements. We have to go kind of fast. We only have 4 minutes left. So, Jim Chaplin.
Okay, Carolyn Payne's Nutcracker. I endorse Big Al Anderson and us at the Iron Horse. But more importantly...
When are you there?
26.
26?
Yeah,
wow.
Come on up. It's going to be great.
Cool. Boxing day.
More important, many years ago was afflicted. I'll try to make this as quick as possible with a really rare and fatal cancer called angiosarcoma. I've never met another person with it until a month ago where I met this tremendous group of people at this address, www.cureasc.org. It's often fatal. There's only 30 to 60 cases a year. These people have managed by themselves to raise $500,000 towards the research of this. They have two trials going at Sloan Kettering. I would love it if you went there and just gave them a dollar.
All right. Well, and we're going to put the link on our website.
That would be awesome.
Absolutely. We'll do that. Give me that.
All right.
Luis.
All right. I'm surrounded by a musician, a dancer, and a singer. In the spirit of the season, I think for holiday giving, I would say I strongly encourage people to give music or music lessons, dance lessons, go to a show, and so on. And I have besides the endorsement of the show that Carolyn has, also two recommendations of albums. Nowadays, it's just downloads, I guess, of the albums. For one is and both of them are reinterpretations. The first one is a reinterpretation of songs by Donna Summer. The album is called Love to Love You, Donna, and it's a group of electronic dance producers, DJs, reinterpreting the songs of Donna Summer. There's some that are really sick that you should listen to and dance to. And the second one is an album called Sergio George Presents Salsa Giants, which was recently nominated for a Grammy in the salsa category, or they call tropical music, which I had as a label. These are classical songs reinterpreted in a live concert. Terrific album. So give music, learn music.
And we'll get these titles up on WNPR.org because people may not have been able to write them down. All right, you're up.
All right, I am endorsing Kinetic Dance, Nutcracker Sweet and Spicy this weekend, starting tonight, 8 p.m., tomorrow night at 8, and Sunday at 2 with our Ugly Sweater Christmas party that's going to have Hartford Hot Several, and Jim is wearing a great ugly sweater today. So it's a Nutcracker unlike you've ever seen before, lots of fun. It has a big mishmash of dancing, everything from tap, jazz, ballet, hip-hop. And Tandway Rum is our sponsor, and they will be serving cocktails in the lobby. So come. There's a beautiful new backdrop by artist Nina Salazar. Mm. So I hope to see everyone there.
All right. So this is the Wadsworth Athenaeum. It's 8 o'clock tonight, 8 o'clock Saturday, and there's a matinee on Sunday. I'll be there Saturday night. I just switched my ticket. I'm going to quickly endorse as a gift a book called Reading Lyrics. It's edited by Robert Gottlieb, the former New Yorker editor, and somebody else. It's an older book. But if you love the American Songbook, or you're going to give a gift to somebody who loves the American Songbook, get this is terrific. I mean, I know a lot about the American Songbook. In fact, you can bring the music up right now behind me because I just for this, I picked a song by Alec Wilder. You can sort of geek out about these fabulous songwriters. This is a song by Alec Wilder called Blackberry Winter. I'm also endorsing Alec Wilder. This is Hillary Cole singing this fabulous song. We'll put this up on the website as well. But if you need to give a gift to a music lover, reading lyrics, and it's just the lyrics of these amazing, amazing songs from, I don't know, about 1910 to whenever the American Songbook era ended.
Aw, shucks, Kyone.
What's wrong, Greg?
I'm not sure if I got this southern thing down.
Nah, your southern accent ain't so bad. Say shoot.
Shoot.
Say aw, shucks.
Aw, shucks.
Now make something up that don't make no sense.
Man, get heck now, see what I was in.
Nailed it.